John Marcus did from Northfield, Minnesota. And I teach at St. Olaf College. And I'm here with my wife Bobby and good friend Solvay Bird. I am primarily a school teacher, and I work with young people who are doing lots of different kinds of things, but one of the things they're trying to do is figure out who they are. And I'm always conscious of that when I'm teaching my subject. My subject happens to be art. And I primarily work in art history and interdisciplinary courses in the humanities. So I'm working with literature people and history people and religion and so on. And I'm also a painter and a sculptor and a printmaker, and I make banners and church bulletin covers and all of those things. But most of the time I'm a teacher. And I've decided to spend my time here focusing on women in art. And this is not necessarily because I've become a militant feminist or because I'm an authority on women's studies. I'm a beginning student in this area, but I think it's very important that I get involved in this area. About 12 years ago, a student came up to me after a class and really nailed me to the wall and said, "Do you realize what you're saying in your classes?" and started to quote me. And she made me realize that I was using exclusive male language in talking about women. And I stand there talking about this painting of a luscious woman, and I would talk about the artist's conception of universal man. I didn't realize I was doing things like that. And my whole campus certainly is very sensitive to the woman's movement. And I would be the first to confess that I've identified the strident, angry feminists on the campus. Whenever I see them coming, I run and hide. But I also have said that I realize that this is important, that there have to be these people around to shake us all up. Revolutions have to start, I mean, unfortunately, but usually revolutions have to start with some kind of aggressive act. The American Revolution involved dumping tea in the ocean. I don't especially like tea, so I don't see that as a very terrible act, but I know some of you would go to war over that gesture. So those kinds of things have been happening to me, and so this year I decided it's about time I have a course on women for the art department. And I went into that thing shaking and trembling, and I got involved with 20 very beautiful, wonderful women, very eager to listen to this great authority talk, and I had to learn from them. And we sat down and figured out what we ought to do and kind of groped our way through it. And I think we ended up with a wonderful, satisfying experience. I have gotten close to some students in the past, and I realized that maybe, I'm not a psychologist, but I realized that maybe at the heart of the problem might be some kind of sexual identity. And so in the case of some women, I've steered them towards some interesting women artists as possible topics for term papers. And I did that with a girl this year, and she came as a brand new person and said, "I've suddenly realized that I don't have to look like my mother, who's a glamorous woman." This girl didn't feel comfortable being a glamorous woman. She said that because of this study, she suddenly felt quite comfortable with herself. She felt she had a long ways to go, but suddenly she understood why her dad married this movie star that was her mother. And she didn't turn out like that at all. Well, those are some of the background. So what I want to talk about tonight also makes me a little bit uncomfortable. It's easier to talk about what I'm going to talk about to young men and women. And you people know all of this stuff already, so it might be a little bit redundant. But what I want to do is to just touch on some things that are part of our Western culture, Western civilization. And I think they're embodied in our ways of thinking. And I think it's just now that some of these attitudes are being rooted out of our consciousness. And this basically has to do with the fundamental relationship between men and women. That's what I would like to talk about. And during this week, tonight I'll talk about the image of the nude figure in art, in Western art, in famous paintings by Rubens, Rembrandt, Titian, Tintoretto, and some of those men who have made it into the sacred halls of the great museums. And tomorrow I'd like to talk about a woman at the beginning of the Baroque age, Artemisia Gentileschi, and I put down as my topic voyeurism, Susanna and the Elders, and I put that word voyeurism in there just as a come on. I will touch on the subject. I guess basically what I'm talking about tonight, in a sense, is also voyeurism. Voyeurism is peeping Tomism, and in a sense, that's what the great Western art has been about. The matter, I mean, even when it's about supposedly historical themes or Christian themes, it's still, there still is that opportunity to be a peeping Tom. The next day I'd like to talk about two well-known American women artists, Mary Cassar and Georgia O'Keeffe, and try to look at the idea, or ask the question, is there anything special about what women do when they make paintings? And some people deny that there's anything different about in the work of women or men. And then the last day, on Saturday, I'd like to talk about the quilt makers. And that's a subject I never heard about before. I got a woman in my class to make a presentation on quilt making. And I suddenly realized that my definitions of the whole tradition of art were very narrow. Art is usually done by this original genius sitting up in his attic looking at his own navel. And we prize a work of art because we can name it. We own a Picasso, we own a Rembrandt, we own a Michelangelo, we own a Rich Cameron. That's the ultimate achievement. But quilt making militates against that whole idea because it's done by a group of women who enjoy each other, who have high standards, who often kick women out of their group because they're not good enough at their craft. But nevertheless, it's a very strong, legitimate art form, but it's done by committee, not by the solitary genius. So this is Rosie, and we'll talk about her on Saturday. She's ranking very high in my hierarchy of values in terms of the arts. I'd like to talk, what I'm saying tonight is based on a book that comes from a British Broadcasting Company television show. The name of the book is Ways of Seeing, and the author is John Berger. And together with five other people, they did a study about seeing in Western civilization, about the visual world of advertising, about how do we know things. All of those kinds of elements were part of this book. So I'm really indebted to that book in most of the choices of the images I'll talk about. John Berger starts out by talking about the male social presence is defined by a sense of what the male can do to or for us. And this can be in terms of economics, in terms of politics, it can be sexually, can be a sexual issue. We judge a man by his impact on us in terms of the way he conducts himself, or at least the way he pretends to conduct himself. And it might be just a sham. He might put on a cowboy hat and cowboy boots and put a pack of Marlboro cigarettes in his pocket, but he somehow doesn't impress us as being a very powerful person, especially with a wild cow. So we probably dismiss him. Women's social presence is defined by other factors. They're intrinsic to the woman herself. And it's basically determined by what she thinks of herself, about her gestures, about her environment, about the kinds of clothes she puts on, Women's presence is, according to Berger, is defined by her sense of what other people see her as, how she appears to other people. And success in life for a woman basically depends upon how she comes across to other people, and especially to men. And so the central thesis in this book is that in our Western tradition, basically men act and women appear. And these kinds of conditions are brought out in the whole tradition of Western art history. It's the man who do things, it's the men who are the agents, the men are the agents of God, and women are the recipients of it, but their main job is simply to be, to appear in the presence of the man. Young girls are socialized to constantly be aware of how they move, how they act, the inflection of the voice, their manners, how they dress, how they comb their hair, how they appear to other people. Women are conscious of themselves being looked at, so they are both the surveyor but also the surveyed. And that aspect of themselves that's being surveyed one might call male. So what happens is that the woman treats herself as a vision, as a sight, as an object, as a thing. And when we turn something into an object, we tend to use it as an object. And that's I think, the problem in the whole tradition of Western art, which is Western values made very concrete and specific. And I think it's just now in the latter part of the 20th century that we're suddenly very conscious of that, and we're trying to root out those attitudes. And I think the women's movement is a very healthy movement because it's helping women to be themselves, in and of themselves, not as objects, not as appearances, not as something to be surveyed or to be looked at, not as passive, neutral objects. Well, it all begins in paradise, which was someplace like Holden Village. And this is from the 15th century. See, I got to make myself food here. This is from the 15th century, from a book of Auer's, a wonderful book made by the Limburg brothers for the Duke de Berry. And it's about the creation story. And over here, the serpent, who happens to be a woman, is giving the apple to Eve. And over here, Eve gives the apple to Adam. And over here, we have God passing judgment on Eve. I have some details of this. I think it's important to notice that the male genitals are exposed in this detail. This is Adam before he's conscious of his nakedness, before he eats the apple. And so this is the artist's way of talking about that original state of innocence. Eve happens to be a very fashionable image. I mean, she represents the ideal form in the 15th century in the Flemish, Burgundian, French world. She has this, she almost looks like she's a pregnant form. This was the fashion, and that high forehead also represents the fashion. This morning, Rich was talking about how the language constantly changes and how the artist is imaging the world as he sees it at the time. And this artist is imaging man and woman presented as ideal forms at that precise moment. But this is sort of off the topic. In the Genesis story, Eve sees the food, sees the apple. She thinks it will be good food. She wants to eat that good food. She knows that the food will make her wise. She desires that kind of wisdom. Probably her motives were absolutely honorable, except that she's been told by God that she mustn't do this. So she eats the apple, and suddenly Adam and Eve are conscious of their nakedness, and they cover themselves. And they cover themselves because suddenly they're aware of themselves being looked at by other people. But it's something that's taking place in their mind. But a very important part of this, and this is part of the harangue of the women's movement, is that God is judging Eve, and it doesn't seem that he's really judging Adam. Eve is responsible for the evil in the world, or this error. And I think it's interesting that Eve covers Adam and hides Adam's nakedness, and God the Father covers Adam. The men are ganging up here on this poor woman. That's been the way it's been. Eve is the source of evil. Eve is the source of error and ignorance and stupidity and insanity and everything bad. Indigestion and headaches and mosquito bites. Everything can be heaped upon this poor woman. And it's complicated, too complicated to talk about how we worked our way out of that, but just quickly, one solution was the development of the cult of Virgin Mary. But that's where it all started. And this is a 15th century Flemish painting. Adam's trying to resist. I'm sure in this painting, he's pointing towards God and saying, God told us we mustn't do this. And Eve is very aggressive. And Adam can hardly resist this very aggressive woman, really leans over on him. We have to feel sorry for him. There's no way he can resist this tempting woman. So that, let's see, I didn't want to turn off all the lights, but this is Susanna and the Elders. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that tomorrow, maybe if I hide the light here. Susanna and the Elders is a theme that comes from the apocryphal books of the Bible. And I'll go into the subject matter tomorrow and why this is happening. But the elders are spying on Susanna, who's taking a bath. And this is an example of voyeurism. And they're getting some kind of satisfaction out of seeing this woman in this condition. And we, too, are invited to stare at Susanna. So we're no different from the elders. We, too, are peeking at Susanna taking a bath. And we can vicariously, and in a very sexual way, enjoy this experience of seeing this woman unveiled. But we're excused because she's looking in the mirror. And she's looking at herself. And in this, probably she also sees you and I reflected in the mirror, so she's aware of us looking at her, looking at herself. It is this problem of the woman being cultivated and the culture and conditioned to be aware of herself as a vision, as a sight, as something that is being seen. And she's consciously conducting herself in such a way that she's always on a stage and that she's aware that she is this appearance. But the mirror is a symbol of vanity, and vanity is one of the vices. So we can say it's okay for us to vicariously be voyeurists or peeping toms, because what we're really doing is making moral judgments against Susanna, because she's a very vain woman and she spends her time looking at herself in the mirror. And that, in a sense, legitimizes our peeking at her. And so that's a major subject in Western European painting. This is Titian, Venus and the Mirror. We could go into the whole idea of Venus as a Christian allegory, but that would take another hour. There are ways to make this subject legitimate, but I think basically Venus is presented frontally to our view, and a frontal presentation of the female body is meant to be an erotic experience, which we can participate in. But then again, she's looking in the mirror, and so we can judge her harshly because she's this very vain, very self-centered person. But everything I've been saying seems to suggest that everything we do when we educate our women is to turn them into this kind of self-centered, vain sort of person, constantly adjusting herself because she's on this stage. This is 17th century Spain, the reclining Venus figure called the Rope Venus by Velázquez. And again, it's the idea of Venus adoring herself in the mirror. And we get this wonderful relationship of this woman's curvaceous bottom juxtaposed against this dim view of her face. I think the bottom is probably more important than the face. And we can, again, for the reasons I just stated, justify that kind of concentration on that relationship, because it's not nice to sit and admire yourself. There's the subject of the Miss America contest, which begins with the judgment of Paris, was the cause of the Trojan War, because poor Paris, this poor innocent shepherd boy, was asked by Helen, Helen of Troy, and two other women, Venus, Aphrodite. It's in my notes someplace. Asked by the three most, these three most beautiful women, who is most beautiful of us all? And he is to give the golden apple to the most beautiful. And because of the person he chooses, the other people are angry, and the Trojan War is the result. Well, what really happens is that only one person can be the most beautiful, and the other two women are losers, and that means they're ugly. And in the Miss America contest, there's that moment where they announce the winner, and she cries. And then all of her princesses come and hug her, and they're all smiling, but you know they want to kill her, because suddenly they're ugly. They're losers, and there can only be one most beautiful person. This is Rubens' version of the Judgment of Paris. I was just thinking about all the beauty queens in Minnesota. One of the most interesting is at Waterville. It's Miss Bullhead. Iowa people like to come up to Waterville and fish for bullheads. So they have this great festival in the summer, and then they elect the most beautiful Miss Bullhead of the season. It seems a little bit like a contradiction. You know what a bullhead looks like. There's Miss Pork and Miss Cow and Miss Ice Cream and all those things. But there's one other element to suggest. The judge, Paris, chooses one of these women. And one of these women then becomes the property of Paris. The judge selects, we have a jury in the Miss America contest, but basically there's a judge, and when he chooses somebody, that woman is his property, his thing, his object, to be used in any way that he chooses. And furthermore, somebody buys this painting, and the person who buys the painting is really buying this new figure, this woman, who has become this appearance, who's incapable of really doing anything except be chosen by a man. But I didn't know if I dare bring the slides that I wanted to talk about here. In the Western tradition, in the Western tradition, the female form is always passive. She sits there frontally as a nude figure. There's often not a man in the painting, but we can assume that the man is the purchaser of the painting. He is the spectator, and he's outside of the painting, and he is the person who is sexually aroused, who has feelings, who has passion, who has thoughts, who can do something, and she just sits there. In all other cultures, other than the West, when men and women are shown in a kind of sexual relationship or in any kind of erotic relationship, it's always a mutual relationship. Men and women are actively engaged and totally absorbed in each other, and nobody is passive. You look at every culture, in Peru, Indian cultures, Oriental cultures, it's always a union, it's an entity, it's an organic whole. But in the Western tradition, the woman is a thing and incapable of acting. And it's only the man who does anything. Would have been fun to go into that topic in great detail. But this is a painting that's really disturbing for a lot of reasons, but partly for its treatment of women. Woman. And I think it's a very true image of our modern, Western, post-Renaissance, post-Baroque, Rococo, 19th century world, which has turned the woman into an appearance. This is a large painting. It's not quite as large as the image on the screen. It's in the National Gallery in London. When you come upon it, it really is arresting. The blue color back here is so intense. And then you play that blue against this porcelain skin that's very white, and it just screams out at you. And it says, stop here and look. And you hardly can go on. The painting was a gift from the Grand Duke of Florence to the King of France after the Reformation in the 16th century. And I don't have time to really get into the subject, but probably on one level, it is a kind of hellfire and brimstone sermon. Sometimes it's called the exposure to luxury, and this man is whipping back this large tent-like form, and underneath there's this incestuous relationship going on between Cupid, who is the son of Venus. And I think that's disturbing. I don't like to see sons doing this to their mothers. So maybe on one level we could say, well, this is a wonderful wonderful moral sermon against this kind of insanity. But obviously, that's not the point of the painting. We're meant to enjoy and participate in what's going on in the painting. Venus is this nude figure, this idealized figure, carefully painted. The surfaces are like porcelain, they're like china. They're just exquisite in the way it's painted. But her position is really unnatural and awkward. She presents herself frontally to the viewer. There's no attempt to hide anything. So the painting is meant to stimulate, I think, the sexual desires of the spectator. We can assume that the spectator is a man. The spectator is the King of France. He owns this woman. He owns this painting. He owns this image. Another aspect of the painting is that the woman has no pubic hair, and the hair that's on her head is very carefully tightened up. Hair is an image of passion. It's an embodiment of passion. It's an embodiment of feeling, and this woman is incapable of feeling. She is sexless. She is emotionless. She is this form being presented to this viewer. The passion resides in the spectator, not in the woman. And so she's only there to serve this man and his sexual interests or his appetites. He's the only one who needs to be satisfied. She needs no satisfaction because she has nothing. She is a vision. She's a sight. She's an object. So if we talk about becoming fully human, if we talk about dehumanization, for the last decade, people have been haranguing about woman as sex object, and I'm basically doing the same thing, but it's deep-seated in our traditions. Maybe we're not aware of it, but I think this painting is an example of how persistent that whole idea is. A student at St. Olaf did a wonderful senior project where she studied the diary of a Victorian woman that she found. And she wrote a drama with music. She designed the costumes. And it was a very powerful experience. And I recognized my own grandmother and what she was talking about. This woman, I don't think, realized what she was telling the latter part of the 20th century. But she talked about her infancy and the way she remembered things that her parents did to her to help her grow up to be a proper lady. She remembered that horrible, inhumane day when she had to put on a corset and she couldn't breathe and she couldn't sit down, but she had to walk like a wooden soldier. She was an appearance, not a real human being. She talked about her courtship and her marriage and what was expected of her as a bid partner and all of these kinds of things, and it was devastating. I recognize my grandparents. I think they went through that same kind of thing. Well, a late 19th century painting of the Venus figure again, beautifully painted by Ingres, but she looks at us and she knows we're looking at her. And there is a very solemn expression here, very coy. I don't know if I should use the word coy, but at least she knows what her job is, and that's to be this thing stimulating the viewer who is a man. There is hair, but it is so perfectly concealed, it becomes a kind of sculptural form that I think we're not aware of it as this symbol of this very natural kind of state that wild hair often expresses. This was painted by one of the most prominent, most highly respected French painters at the end of the 19th century, Bouguereau. And everybody thought that he represented Raphael and Michelangelo reincarnate, and he took a position of great authority and power in the museums. But I think it's an example of how crazy values were at the end of the 19th century. This painting was commissioned by Hoffman's Bar in New York City. And it's this satyr being dragged off into the woods by nymphs. And standing in front of the bar are important political leaders of our nation, or corporation executives. And they're doing their dickering at the bar, and somebody is a loser. Somebody loses the argument and has to go away. But he can look up at this great painting behind the bar, and this painting would reinforce the notion that he's really a man. And all that really matters is that these women are after him. They're going to drag him off into the woods to do whatever it is women do to satyrs out in the woods. So he's flattered. He's constantly flattered by the gestures of these women. And so it doesn't matter that he just lost United Steel, or he had to give away the United States, or whatever it was. He still is basically a powerful man. The Bouguereau is, there are a lot of these kinds of cases. This is another Bouguereau painting, held to be highly moral, highly significant. It's called The Education of Bacchus, and it's justified as a mythological kind of statement. But actually, it's an occasion to present these sexual objects cavorting around the figure of Bacchus. So most of the time, I feel bad, really bad. My business is to talk about Western art, and it grieves me when I suddenly start to realize what famous Western artists have been doing to half of our society for centuries. And I think I'm ashamed of it. I'm embarrassed by it. And it's that kind of awareness that made me start being more careful, more sensitive to what was going on in my own subject matter. I don't think every artist is guilty. This is Rembrandt, Danae. And Danae is being visited by Jupiter, which often becomes an occasion for another voyeuristic experience. You can see this dirty old man horsing around with these nymphs. Rembrandt painted his own wife. And in most paintings, even when there's a suitor, the suitor here is Zeus or Jupiter, in most paintings, the woman is there for the client, the spectator, the person who bought the painting. And the person who buys a painting knows that the man in the case isn't going to win, that he's going to end up with the woman after all. But in certain cases, and Rembrandt is one of these, his realism is so intense, and he's so much involved with this woman who happens to be his wife, and it is such a private and personal and subjective kind of experience that I don't think we feel like intruding. We know we are not spectators out here being invited into this bed to compete with Jupiter. Rembrandt's realism is so specific, especially in this painting of Bathsheba, where Rembrandt gets involved in the particular qualities of this woman, her fat, the bumps, the blemishes. There are drawings by Rembrandt of the nude female form, And a lot of critics called it ugly. But it wasn't really ugly, it was just very truthful. And that brings up the question of the naked and the nude, which is kind of a subtle subject. Sir Kenneth Clark wrote a book called The Nude. And basically, a naked person is a person without any disguise. Nudity is a form of dress. Nudity is a kind of disguise or a cloak. To be a nude figure is to become this vision, this perfect vision, this sight, this object. To become a naked person, to be a naked person is simply to be oneself. And most Western artists do not allow the nude image of the female to be herself. Western art turns this nude, this naked woman into a perfect nude object. And so, in a sense, I think we would feel like we were intruding if we had any kind of a notion of getting involved with Rembrandt's Bathsheba, because she really is a naked figure. And I'll say something more about that. Well, I remember the day I got drafted into the Army, and some of you had that horrible experience. And you're herded together with 100 other men, and you walk around naked all day long, getting jabbed and poked. I think the whole point of it is to break you down, to work you into a state of submission to the system, because the sooner you quit fighting the Army, the more happy you will be. But part of the memory is seeing naked, hundreds of naked men. We're all the same. There's nothing really different from one person to the next. And that's one of the qualities of the naked figure. I'll say some more about that. This is Rubens' portrait of his wife, Helena Formant. It's called the nude, let's see, Helena Formant in a fur coat. And probably a moment before we saw her without any covering, but she's pulling this garment around her. Her hair is disheveled and her hair is very prominent. The figure is very specific. I mean, she really needs to come to Holden and eat some healthy food. And he's not trying to hide that. He's not interested in her appearing to the world as some kind of perfect goddess. John Berger points out, he talks about this painting, he points out how this line doesn't really connect with this line, and that how there really is a great deal of distortion in the figure. And he uses that as an argument to suggest that Helena Formant is a deep part of Rubens' own subjectivity. This is a very private image, and it's Rubens' passionate involvement with Helena Formant. We are intruders if we treat it in any other way. And so she is a naked figure. She's not this object, this thing, this nude figure, this idealized abstraction, this dehumanized perfect form. She is a specific person with all of her particular bumps. Clothing is more than Puritan modesty. Clothing is important because clothing forces our attention on the mouth, the eyes, the shoulders, the body language, the gestures of the hand. These gestures are extremely complex gestures capable of the most wide range of communication. And people are interesting because of that. But they're also mysterious. We don't know them. We can't get at them. But you take off their clothes, and they are very common. Our focus shifts from the eyes and the hands and the gestures to the sexual center of the figure, and everybody's built the same. And the sexual center of the human figure is very simple. It has a kind of almost mechanical function. There's a process involved, and there's no mystery there at all. So to see somebody naked is to suddenly be aware of their commonality, their banality. They're friendly human people just like everybody else. But yet that commonality and that sexual center does become the bridge for a very profound, very subjective kind of experience. But what's going on up here is what's really important. So a couple final images. This is Giorgione, a reclining Venus figure. And I hold this in high regard. I think as an example of a new figure, it is a wonderful image of the reclining female form relating to the undulating contours of the landscape. She embodies creation. She is the landscape. She is a real metaphor for nature, for creation. And I think for these people, this really was a religious, a way of describing the sacred quality of nature. But this is quickly denigrated by Giorgione's student, Titian, who took that image and completely demythologized it, took anything poetic, mysterious, and sacred out of it, and turned this woman into this seductress. And the composition is so organized, this drapery points to the sexual center of the figure. Her assistants are trying to find her the proper clothing for her for the day, but we hope that they're going to have a hard time picking out the dress so we could linger over this woman as long as possible. She's inviting us to come in and participate in this, well, with her body and with the space. Everything about the painting keeps us out. So we're not allowed to come close to her. We only can view her as, not as a real person to participate with, but as this perfect thing. And at the end of the 19th century, a man named Manet decided it was about time to call her to a screeching halt. And he paraphrased Titian's painting in his famous painting called Olympia. And the model for this painting is a well-known prostitute. And so he calls a spade, and he says, this is what we've been doing to women for centuries. And he brings in a black servant, and he closes up the space. He puts in a black cat instead of a little puppy dog. There's that cute little puppy down there. The space is different. He flattens out forms. He turns it into the beginning of modern, almost abstract painting. But I think Manet knew what he was doing. So I would say that a lot of recent artists have even been criticizing this, and I think we should be aware of the fact that I think artists are very moral people. They're deeply human. They're profoundly concerned with human values. And even crazy modern artists are, and I'll show an example. This is Mel Ramos, who takes the whole idea of the Venus figure and turns it into the cheapest, trashiest kind of girly picture you could imagine. And obviously, he knows what he's doing. And I don't think this is the same as Bronzino's Cupid playing with his mother, Venus. I think Mel Ramos is a very harsh critic of these values. This is Larry Rivers, and he gives us two versions. We can have Olympian black and white. And in a sense, he's poking fun at the whole tradition of Western painting. And a lot of what the latter part of the 20th century is doing is taking a lot of the air and the stuffiness and the hypocrisy out of what I think most of us would value as very sacred. When we go to the Metropolitan Museum in New York, we feel like we're going into church, and we walk around whispering and tiptoeing. And just because it's old, it's got to be good. But if you look very closely, and you think about how the human figures are being presented, then there's cause for some concern. And it's that kind of awareness that made me go back and start thinking about what these things mean. I put this on a final exam, Tom Wesselman's The Smoker, and I put it next to another painting, and I asked people to choose, to discuss the two paintings. Then I asked them to choose one. I said, you have to buy one of these. You have to justify your purchase. Well, I was surprised that a majority of the class voted for Tom Wesselman's Smoker, and they talked about how beautiful it was. And I realized I hadn't made a dent on anybody. Because Tom Wesselman reduces the female form to a faceless sexual orifice with a phallic cigarette covered with plastic Revlon. And it's perfectly painted. It's absolutely smooth. It's perfection itself. But there's no person here. And so it seems like the most horrible indictment of Western values, that we would end up at the end of the 20th century presenting our reclining Venus figure has a wide open mouth covered with some synthetic material. And the last slide is not a Tom Wesselman, and I think this says what I'm trying to say more clearly. It's this faceless woman with this mouth covered in some kind of material with all kinds of objects that point towards some kind of sexual attributes, but they're not, I think it's still like the Renaissance. She doesn't possess any kind of feeling or emotion. She has no subjectivities. She's not a person. She's just this perfectly stamped out, perfectly made object.